Welcome to the Whistleblower Newsroom. I'm Christina Borgeson here with my co-host Celia Farber. In keeping with a key aim of our show, which is to persistently focus on big third rail issues of our time, we have for you today, I'd call him super journalist, James Corbett, founder, webmaster.
I would too.
Producer and editor of the Corbett Report, an outlet for independent critical analysis of politics, society, history, and economics. And the Corbett Report has been around for well more than a decade. Corbett has produced thousands of hours of audio and video media for his website, which includes a podcast and many online documentaries and series. Anyone familiar with his work, and I've followed his work for years, anyone familiar with his work knows that Corbett is a reporter who maintains a laser beam focus on the facts, and that he conducts ongoing investigations of third rail issues, particularly 9/11. No one can pinpoint the BS in false narratives like Corbett. He's here today to discuss 9/11 and his must-see documentary, as well as it's broken down into a series, too, called 9/11 Whistleblowers. So what our listeners are going to get today, excuse me, is the clearest, most forthright account of what's true and what isn't, who the 9/11 whistleblowers are, who the bad guys are in this story, and what's new in the international effort to get accountability for the past and ongoing crimes associated with this horrific event. Welcome, James. We're thrilled to have you.
Welcome.
I'm thrilled to be here, and with such a glowing introduction, I only hope I can live up to it, but we certainly will live up to the title of touching the third rail issue. In fact, it is probably the issue that got me into journalism in the first place and doing what it is that I do, so it's one that I'm very passionate about.
Well, you have already earned this glowing praise because you've been at it for so long, and I'm familiar with your work, and that's how I view your work. So I want to start today with a video piece. To me, it's unforgettable. I saw it, how long ago was it that you did it? But it's an excellent example of your sublimely well-honed BS detector. It's a breakdown of the official narrative for 9/11. Hilarious and infuriating at the same time. I think it's something everyone should hear, and I want to kick off our show with you with that piece, if you don't mind. So, Jess, could you play that piece for us? Jess is our wonderful engineer that we love very much.
On the morning of September 11th, 2001, 19 men armed with box cutters directed by a man on dialysis in a cave fortress halfway around the world using a satellite phone and a laptop directed the most sophisticated penetration of the most heavily defended airspace in the world, overpowering the passengers and the military combat trained pilots on four commercial aircraft before flying those planes wildly off course for over an hour without being molested by a single fighter interceptor. These 19 hijackers, devout religious fundamentalists who like to drink alcohol, snort cocaine, and live with pink-haired strippers, managed to knock down three buildings with two planes in New York. While in Washington, a pilot who couldn't handle a single-engine Cessna was able to fly a 757 in an 8,000-foot descending 270-degree corkscrew turn to come exactly level with the ground, hitting the Pentagon in the budget analyst office where DoD staffers were working on the mystery of the $2.3 trillion that Defense Secretary Donald Rumsfeld had announced missing from the Pentagon's coffers in a press conference the day before, on September 10th, 2001. Luckily, the news anchors knew who did it within minutes.
Osama bin Laden.
The pundits knew within hours.
Osama bin Laden.
The administration knew within the day.
Terrorists who committed these acts and those who harbor them.
And the evidence literally fell into the FBI's lap.
That a hijacker's passport was found blocks from the World Trade Center crash site, if you can believe that.
But for some reason, a bunch of crazy conspiracy theorists demanded an investigation into the greatest attack on American soil in history. That investigation was delayed, underfunded, set up to fail, a conflict of interest, and a cover-up from start to finish. It was based on testimony extracted through torture, the records of which were destroyed. It failed to mention the existence of WTC-7, Able Danger, PTEC, Sibel Edmonds, OBL and the CIA, and the drills of hijacked aircraft being flown into buildings that were being simulated at the precise same time that those events were actually happening. It was lied to by the Pentagon, the CIA, the Bush administration, and as for Bush and Cheney, well, no one knows what they told it because they testified in secret, off the record, not under oath, and behind closed doors. It didn't bother to look at who funded the attacks because that question is ultimately of little practical significance. Still, the 9/11 Commission did brilliantly answering all of the questions the public had, except most of the victims' family members' questions, and pinned blame on all the people responsible, although no one so much as lost their job, determining the attacks were
failure of imagination.
Because
nobody in our government, at least, and I don't think the prior government that could envision flying airplanes into buildings.
Except the Pentagon, FEMA, NORAD, and the NRO. The DIA destroyed 2.5 terabytes of data on Able Danger, but that's okay because it probably wasn't important. The SEC destroyed their records on the investigation into the insider trading before the attacks, but that's okay because destroying the records of the largest investigation in SEC history is just part of routine record keeping. NIST has classified the data that they used for their model of WTC-7's collapse, but that's okay because knowing how they made their model of the collapse would jeopardize public safety. The FBI has argued that all material related to their investigation of 9/11 should be kept secret from the public, but that's okay because the FBI probably has nothing to hide. This man never existed, nor is anything he had to say worthy of your attention, and if you say otherwise, you are a paranoid conspiracy theorist and deserve to be shunned by all of humanity. Likewise him, 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 and her. And her, and her, and him. Osama bin Laden lived in a cave fortress in the hills of Afghanistan, but somehow got away. Then he was hiding out in Tora Bora, but somehow got away. Then he lived in Abbottabad for years, taunting the most comprehensive intelligence dragnet employing the most sophisticated technology in the history of the world for a decade, releasing video after video with complete impunity and getting younger and younger as he did so, before finally being found in a daring SEAL team raid which wasn't recorded on video, in which he didn't resist or use his wife as a human shield, and in which these crack special forces operatives panicked and killed this unarmed man, supposedly the best source of intelligence about those dastardly terrorists on the entire planet. Then they dumped his body in the ocean before telling anyone about it. Then a couple dozen of that team's members died in a helicopter crash in Afghanistan. This is the story of 9/11, brought to you by the media which told you the hard truths about
his head could be seen to move violently forward.
And
they took the babies out of incubators.
And
mobile production facilities.
And
the rescue of Jessica Lynch.
If you have any questions about this story, you are a batshit, paranoid, tinfoil, dog-abusing baby hater and will be reviled by everyone. If you love your country and or freedom, happiness, rainbows, rock and roll, puppy dogs, apple pie, and your grandma, you will never ever express doubts about any part of this story to anyone. Ever. This has been a public service announcement by the Friends of the FBI.
Oh, you see, what a masterpiece.
That's why I love James Corbett. This guy is brilliant, and he just gets right to the... Okay, so James, we want to talk about the 9/11 whistleblowers. Because as you state at the very beginning of your longer documentary, I know you did separate smaller pieces on these people. People always say, oh, yeah, well, 9/11, if it was a conspiracy, how come there are no whistleblowers? And you show that they are. So why don't you talk about the whistleblowers that you found?
Well, I think it's first important to note that there's no article there. It's not the 9/11 whistleblowers, it's 9/11 whistleblowers, because I have collected here a handful of what I think are important stories to tell when it comes to 9/11 and whistleblowing, but certainly not the only stories to tell. And over the years, I've told the stories of a number of people, some of whom I mentioned in that video you just played, like Robert Wright or people like that, Richard Grove and others who,
Sybil
Singh, for example.
Yeah.
A number of people who have stories that I think are important with regards to 9/11, but I did select these particular ones for this particular documentary because I think they do a good job of representing the idea, the central idea, which is a rebuke against that old canard that if there was something fishy about 9/11, there'd be someone to blow the whistle on it. Well, I want to tell people there have been, in fact, numerous people who have blown the whistle, and they have been, as your listeners will no doubt not be surprised to hear, systematically ignored by the very system that, well, they're trying to blow the whistle on.
Right, right. So give us, you know, give us some of the narratives that you included in this, in your documentary. Talk about, for example, Kate Jenkins. We actually had Kevin.
Well, I talk about Kevin Ryan, who I know
Hold on. We cannot hear you. I don't know if you're still. I don't know. I think we've lost him.
I am still here. Can you hear me?
He's back.
There we go. Oh, yeah, we actually had Kevin on our show here, and he told us his story. So, but briefly remind the audience about Kevin Ryan.
Kevin Ryan, as you talked to him a few weeks ago, he was an employee at the Environmental Health Laboratories in South Bend, Indiana, which was, at the time, it was a subsidiary of Underwriters Laboratories. And the head of UL, the CEO at that time, Loring Knobloch, came to Kevin Ryan's site in Indiana in the weeks following 9/11 and made an offhand comment that Underwriters Laboratory had underwritten the steel in the World Trade Center. And said that almost as a point of pride, you know, Underwriters Laboratories is so big and important, we'd write everything, including the World Trade Center. Kevin Ryan filed that away. It wasn't until years later, as Underwriters Laboratory was assisting NIST in the official government investigation into the collapse of the towers, that comment started to resonate. Wait, we underwrote the steel in those buildings? But they collapsed exceptionally quickly. In fact, much quicker than would have been anticipated if they had actually lived up to their fire resistance ratings. So what's going on here? And again, as your listeners will hopefully know by now, Kevin Ryan went down that rabbit hole trying to explore what was going on and ultimately got fired from his job as a result of it because he started asking a few too many questions.
Inconvenient
to the person
questions.
Who is, yeah, inconvenient questions, indeed, to NIST itself. So he was summarily fired and then took up the torch and has in fact become an extremely dedicated 9/11 researcher and activist in the years since. So his story is fascinating, but as I say, your listeners should be familiar, hopefully, with that by now. But some of the other people that I talk about in the series include Kate Jenkins, which I find to be a particularly interesting story because I myself, obviously, I've been researching about 9/11 for many years. Kate Jenkins is a name that I may have seen on occasion, but I certainly hadn't delved into until I really got into production of this documentary.
Yeah, and I wasn't familiar
with her. It's a fascinating story.
Yeah, go ahead. Tell it.
Well, I think she's a particularly interesting whistleblower when it comes to 9/11 because a lot of the 9/11 whistleblowers were first-time whistleblowers. It was their first time encountering information like this and trying to blow the whistle. Well, Kate Jenkins was not a first-time whistleblower when it comes to her agency, specifically the Environmental Protection Agency, where she had worked since 1979 as an environmental scientist. She was with the Office of Solid Waste and Emergency Response, and she specialized in dioxin, better known as Agent Orange, which of course was primarily manufactured by Monsanto Chemical Corporation, at least during the Vietnam War. And that led in the 1980s to a lawsuit of employees of the Monsanto Corporation and various servicemen who were saying that their cancers and other health problems were directly linked to the dioxins that they had handled that Monsanto had produced and that they knew were toxic. Monsanto, et cetera. This directly, of course, impinged on Dr. Jenkins and her knowledge, and she ultimately wrote a memo that became an important part of this whole drama, basically blowing the whistle on the EPA, relying on faulty Monsanto-sponsored studies to try to dismiss the link between the Agent Orange and the cancer and other such problems. And that embroiled her in this years-long legal battle. They tried to oust her from her position. She appealed and eventually got her job and position back. And it was a long, years-long nightmare for her specifically. And I imagine at that time, once she got her position back, I imagine she probably thought that would be the end of that.
The
it
last buzzsaw
not,
she'd run
in the wake
into.
Of 9/11,
right.
You're right. Yeah. Unfortunately, not. No, because in the wake of 9/11, the EPA, of course, became heavily involved in the aspect of the cleanup. What kind of cleanup will be needed to get rid of this waste from Manhattan, and how has it affected the air quality, which we now know, of course, is a very large story that has been more or less swept under the rug, except for the thousands upon thousands of dead or dying first responders
right.
who are still suffering from the
so
effects.
So this is a part of the crime
9/11.
That keeps on giving in terms of death, right? And the EPA is connected.
Unfortunately so, yes.
Yeah. EPA was connected to looking into what to use to clean it up, right?
Exactly right. And the I think EPA, at that time, EPA had Christine Todd Whitman, infamous for her statements directly in the wake of 9/11, that the air is safe to breathe. And yes, you should, the first responders should probably wear a mask on Ground Zero itself on the as they're doing the cleanup. But for residents of Lower Manhattan, it's fine and it's safe to breathe. And jeez, that was the gist of EPA's response at that time. Doc.
Uh-oh. I think he's gone out again. Anyway. Okay, so you
hello.
Sort of.
Yeah, we lost you for a second there.
Yeah, so the EPA basically, the EPA basically falsified data, right? They diluted, like in their lab, they diluted the World Trade Center dust with water before testing it. They did something like that. Talk about what it is
that's
the EPA
right.
did.
There were a number of things that she pointed out. In fact, she in 2007, she penned a 134-page letter that really, you must at least see, if not read, all of it. But it's documented, footnoted, and goes through step by step all of the different groups that played a role in the determination of this nonsense that we now know is killing people to this very day. And
wow.
She talked about various things like diluting dust samples 60 plus times before measuring their effects and other things like that. She also pointed out something that I thought was quite interesting with regards to Libby, Montana, which was a designated Superfund site. So the EPA designated it as a special site for special cleanup because it had been adjacent to a gillet mining operation, which for the entire area. And
oh gosh, this connection is terrible.
The asbestos.
Wait, you're going in and out. You're going to have to.
Accruing in heaven.
So it was a Superfund site for cleaning up that had asbestos, right? Is that what you were saying when you were going in and out?
So let's see. Should we try
that is correct,
to make
yes.
a new
and
connection?
And she pointed out that the concentration of a she pointed out that the con-
I think we should okay, everybody. We our guest is calling us from
Japan.
We're in Japan.
I'm not sure.
Okay. Anyway,
I know
Japan.
It's not Tokyo.
Japan and it's far away. And we're having some connection problems. So we're going to see.
We should try the phone number and see if that isn't
okay.
better.
Okay. You're going to go to the phone number? Okay, great. So we'll just talk.
Yeah. So anyway, this I'll just sort of pick up a little bit. So Christine Todd Whitman, she lies and gives out this false information about the air being clean and how, you know. And then later on, when she's confronted about it, she
don't
goes,
just say anything. It's astounding.
Oh, it's unbelievable. Well, and then, yeah, but even then, when she's confronted about it later, she goes, well, that was the best information that was provided to me at the time. And, you know, research has progressed since then. As if, you know, new information had been provided after
right.
She had said what she said. So are you there now, James?
I believe I am.
Oh, that's good. Much better.
Okay, that's better. So, okay, so you were talking about this Superfund site with asbestos. So how does that connect to the EPA covering up the 9/11 stuff?
So Dr. Jenkins' point in that was to say that the Libby, Montana site was declared a Superfund site, and which meant that all of these funds would be committed to the cleanup of the residents in the area, et cetera.
Right.
Despite the fact that the Libby, Montana site had concentrations of asbestos that were 22 times less than the concentration found in residential apartments and other places in Lower Manhattan. So if you were going to declare Libby, Montana a Superfund site and an emergency and it would have to be cleaned up, why not do that in Manhattan? Well,
right.
obviously, because it would be orders of magnitude much more money that would need to be spent. And and obviously it would also cause panic and further hinder the solution to 9/11, which was given to us in the wake of 9/11 by the Bush administration, which was, of course, to continue shopping and continue business as usual.
Well, also, if it became a Superfund site and you had to clean it up, you might have to clean up other things that you wouldn't want to convey to the public existed in the debris, in the remaining debris also, right? I mean,
well, certainly, I think, yeah, if we look at some of the other whistleblowers, including Kevin Ryan, talking about some of the other materials that are in that dust that would indicate evidence of an explosive event, for example, in the World Trade Center, that would be something they wouldn't want. But of course, there were many toxic materials that were contained in that dust, asbestos just being one example of that.
Right. So, okay, so they should have declared it a Superfund site based on other sites that they declared Superfund sites that were much less toxic. So, okay, so she blew the whistle. Kate Jenkins blew the whistle on that. Were there any repercussions for that, for her?
There certainly were, and they were not long in coming. In fact, not only did she write that 134-page letter, which she addressed to then-Senator Hillary Clinton, as well as Congressman Gerald Nadler and Carolyn Maloney, but she also, in 2008, or shortly thereafter, she penned a memo to the FBI trying to get a criminal investigation launched based on her knowledge of this cover-up. Obviously, the EPA was not too happy about that, and coincidentally, in 2010, she was indeed fired from her position, but it was based on, so the EPA said, it was based on a workplace incident that stemmed from this silly back and forth that went on about someone who came in to clean her office that she was complaining was wearing too strong of a perfume or something, They interpreted her reaction as a threat. Physical threat against her supervisor. She's the tiny 5-foot-something woman against the 6-foot-something supervisor. They interpreted it as a physical threat and fired her for it. The long story short is that after 8 years of legal battle, 8 years of appeals, the final verdict finally came down last year that the EPA had improperly terminated her, that it was retaliation for her whistleblowing, that she, in fact, the EPA had deliberately destroyed a number of documents that they had been ordered to keep pertaining to her case, internal memos and communications. And so they ruled in her favor, and she has been restored to her position. To the best of my knowledge, she is still working for the EPA.
Did the FBI ever follow up? Did the FBI follow up on her letter?
Not to my knowledge, no. As far as I know, that FBI letter went into a black hole and was never, did not result in a criminal investigation.
So now talk about Barry Jennings. He's no longer with us, right? He died, but his story is extremely interesting. I mean, talking about the explosives evidence, his story is very interesting.
Right. Well, it seems that he died, which is another interesting part of this tale,
what?
A strange addendum to the tale. But to set the table, Barry Jennings was the deputy director of emergency services for the New York City Housing Authority on 9/11. And so that morning, he was called into World Trade Center Building 7, which was where the Office of Emergency Management had been placed by the Giuliani administration, mayor of New York, of course, at that time, several years earlier, amidst much controversy. It was a very controversial decision to place the Office of Emergency Management in World Trade Center Building 7 directly across from the Twin Towers that had been targeted for terrorist activity in 1993. So that was a whole other thing. But on the morning of 9/11, Barry Jennings was called to the Office of Emergency Management. He arrived. He went up the elevator with someone that he did not know at that time, but later turned out to be Corporation Counsel Michael Hess. And the two of them ended up stumbling out into the Office of Emergency Management, which was completely abandoned. Now, according to Barry Jennings' timeline, they entered the building shortly after the first plane hit the North Tower at 8:46. And so it was around 9 a.m.-ish that they arrived at the Office of Emergency Management. The entire floor was completely abandoned. They said there was steaming cups of coffee. There was half-eaten sandwiches. The place had been abandoned in a hurry. After trying to ascertain what was going on, calling their supervisors, Barry got a hold of someone who said, "Are you actually in the building? Get out of there now." At which point, Michael Hess said, "The elevators aren't working. I found a stairwell. Let's go." And they started running down the stairwell. And at that point, according to Barry Jennings' testimony, there was an explosion somewhere down below them, down from the lobby area. They got to the, I believe, the sixth floor of the building stairwell before they were blown back up by an explosion that took place below them. And the sixth floor was, at least the stairwell, was pretty much
obliterated.
Destroyed.
Yeah.
Obliterated. He said they had to pull themselves up to the eighth floor, where getting their bearings, according to Barry Jennings, he could see that one side of the building, Building 7, was essentially not there. He said, you look one way, there's the building. You look the other way, it's not there. And he said he could see the Twin Towers. He did make a point of that they were both still standing.
Oh, and, interesting. What? Wait a second. This explosion and half the building of 7 is blown away while the Twin Towers are still up? Is that what you just said?
This is the story that Barry Jennings told, yes. And that, of course, for anyone who doesn't understand, that, of course, goes against the narrative of the day, which is that all the damage that took place in World Trade Center Building 7 was a result of the collapse of the Twin Towers. And it was the debris raining down on World Trade Center Building 7 that caused the fires that eventually resulted in the destruction of the building at 5:20 p.m. that afternoon, which still a large number of people don't even know about. But yes, there were three buildings that completely collapsed that day. World Trade Center Building 7 was the third.
Right.
So this is extremely important. And again, we are going based on Barry Jennings' testimony here. And he did make a point of stating this quite clearly, but it was not for several years, actually, after the incident that he was finally tracked down based on a TV clip of just a short interview he had given on that day, which found its way into the hands of Dylan Avery and Jason Burmis, documentary filmakers who, of course, were behind the Loose Change documentary, which was the first really viral internet documentary phenomenon back in the early 2000s. They found this clip, and they tracked Barry Jennings down, asked him for an interview. He was happy to grant it to them. He said he intimated to them he did know their work, so he was not unaware of what it was they were doing. And they were at that time preparing, I believe, for the final cut or the third edition or something like that of Loose Change. So they did take him. They went with him in a van. He drove them to an area where they could get a shot on the top of a building where they had a 20-minute sit-down interview with him. And it was extremely thorough. They definitely went over the timeline. They pressed him on it. Are you sure? Were the Twin Towers still standing? How did you know? He told the story a couple of times about the firefighters that came to rescue him and Hess, who were still trapped obviously up there on the eighth floor. They had broken out of one of the windows. They were screaming, calling for help, and some firefighters had responded. They said he was going to, Barry Jennings said he was going to try to take the fire hose and slide down it, down from the eighth floor down to the street, and the firefighters said, don't do it, that will not hold you. Don't worry, we're coming for you. And then there was panic, confusion, dust, and the firefighters ran away. And then a little while later, they came back, and the same scene played out. And, oh, don't worry, we're coming to get you. And then panic, confusion, something happened. They all ran away.
And the firefighters kept leaving because Building 1 went down, they went away. Building 2 went down, they went away. Is that correct?
That's exactly what Barry Jennings said.
Wow.
And he stressed that point.
Whoa,
they
that's
went away
so
when the first building collapsed, and they came back, and they went away when the second tower collapsed. It was the collapses that they were responding to. So
meanwhile, half of Building 7 is already gone,
according to his testimony. So again, I keep going back to this because it is certainly possible in the confusion of the day that perhaps, I mean, maybe he had the timeline wrong. Maybe there was something different going on than what he understood or could see from his window. But that is exactly, that's what he insisted.
But the key thing,
very insistent.
The key thing, though, is him talking about the explosions from below and his talking about the lobby having been, he walked into a perfectly clean lobby. I mean, everything was intact. And then he left out of a hole in the wall from that lobby, and the lobby was obliterated. right?
Exactly right. In fact, he said it looked like King Kong had stepped through there, and he said that he couldn't even tell it was the lobby. He had to ask a firefighter, "Where are we?" He said, "This is the lobby." He couldn't believe that that was the lobby that he had come in.
Now, let's also remember that NIST, which is the National Institute of Standards and Technology, you know, that's the government's office that was looking into what caused these buildings to be destroyed. They actually, at one point, they basically came out and said they were destroyed due to ordinary office fires and something called thermal expansion, meaning these fires burning slowly were, you know, wearing down the building or something, and then it collapsed, which, I mean, it just, even to somebody who doesn't know anything about much, I mean, that just makes no sense at all, that a steel structure, little office fires would, you know, bring down a steel structure. And also, it doesn't account for the explosions and the complete obliteration of the lobby. But they came out with that, and then they moved the target. And when somebody says, "Oh, that is absurd," then they moved the target. They moved the explanation. And the second, and I've seen this before. We've all seen this movie before. And the next explanation was it was because of a boiler that exploded, right? And unfortunately for them, Jennings was a boiler, an old boiler guy, right? He had worked on boilers. He was familiar with boilers, and he was like, there's no way that it would have been just a boiler.
Can I pull us back into unifying theories? James, do you have one? Do you have a theory of 9/11? Who did it? Why?
Who done it?
How? Or do you focus on, I mean, this is just, the official narrative is so shattered. And by the way, that clip is one of the most extraordinary things
I've
ever
heard.
It's
brilliant.
And it's so funny. And you find yourself, I was just laughing. And I thought, oh my God, I'm laughing at 9/11. But it's masterful. So do you have a theory of what happened on 9/11?
I certainly have my ideas based on the research that I've done over the years of various things that line up better than the official story, but I wouldn't claim to have the unifying theory, the details of who did what in on what day and how it all went down, precisely because all of the relevant information has been so thoroughly covered up and suppressed that, yes, we can make informed speculation, essentially, from our
well, let's break it down a little. Do you have a theory about who? Most people seem to believe, okay, funding, Saudi Arabia.
What?
Certainly there was. There
I
is
think they're
a
part,
trail,
part of something. You know, they might be part of something.
Well, I'm not being very.
Okay, okay, James, you tell us who you. Celia's giving me the hairy eyeball. I don't know if Saudi Arabia is the first country that comes to mind, well, to be perfectly honest.
You know, we
but
all
let's
have our
James.
Different pond where we swim around and get our information. Where I've been, that's obvious. That Saudi
okay, her
Arabia.
Pond is and the Saudi Arabia is, pond.
There certainly is a money trail that leads back to Saudi Arabia, especially the royal family, including, of course, Prince Bandar Bush and his connections to funding some of the alleged hijackers, and I always say alleged because there's a lot to say about that side of the story as well, funding, including the ones that were allowed into the country despite being on terrorist watch lists, despite being CIA purview, living with an FBI informant in Los Angeles. I mean, the story gets crazier and crazier. But when it comes to the unifying theory, my take on this and any other major deep state event that is world-changing in its implications, like a JFK assassination, like a 9/11, is that these types of things generally, I think, do not happen because they benefit one particular player in one
Indeed.
Particular way. No, it's a convergence of many different players who have reason to be involved in a plot like this, which is, I think, sort of spreads out the responsibility so that you may be able to pull a smoking gun here and say, it's all Saudi Arabia. But, of course, that finger pointed out at Saudi Arabia will have
I didn't mean to imply that at all. I just
the reason why the Saudi Arabia alone doesn't make any sense to me is, I mean, if you talk
about Saudi Arabia alone for 9/11, just where I was just talking about the funding.
Okay, but even the funding, because if you look at the next whistleblower on the list that I wanted you to talk about, that guy Michael Springman, if you look at his experience, you've got to say that, there's some CIA fingerprints in this story somewhere.
Well, of course.
Oh, absolutely.
So
yes.
could you talk about him and agency
fingerprints, not just CIA, but certainly CIA. And that does directly impinge on Michael Springman's case. But before we get to that, I should say that I think the money trail question is exceptionally a vitally important question
comes
to 9/11. And it's why I did a documentary a few years ago called 9/11 Trillions, which you can find corporatereport.com/911trillions. It's up there for free, like all my work. And I do explore that issue of the funding and the money side of it from many different perspectives, because like any criminal investigation, the first thing
a good criminal investigator
will do, follow the money. Exactly. Follow the money. So where did the money come from for 9/11? Where did the money go for 9/11? What does it have to do with Donald Rumsfeld's announcement of a new war on September 10th, 2001, against the Pentagon's own bureaucracy, because, we're missing $2.3 trillion. The story is crazy from a number of levels, one of which is provided by the Michael Springman case, as you mentioned, who was working in the Jeddah consulate of the U.S. consulate in Jeddah, I should say, as a consular officer approving visas for people wanting to travel to the United States. And Jeddah, Saudi Arabia, I should say he was doing this in the late 1980s. I believe he arrived in 1987, and I believe he was gone by 1989, I want to say. I may be off by a year or two, but at any rate, he was in the late 1980s working there at the U.S. consulate in Jeddah, where, according to his story, and it's a voluminous story, there's lots of twists and turns, but the long story short is that he was essentially, he was approving visas for terrorists.
He was being forced to approve visas for terrorists, right? I mean, he would say no, and they say you want to keep your job.
There was a lot of pressure. In fact, he was rejecting a number of visas that were then being overturned by higher-ups in the consulate, who, of course, were CIA, as most of the people.
Our sound issue is back. Hold on. Could you repeat what you just said? I don't know if you're repeating what you just said, but...
Michael Springman, part of his story is that he was approving visas... he was denying visas to pre-suspect visa applicants that was then being overturned by his superiors, who he discovered were working with the CIA and NSA and other intelligence agencies. And that is an exceptionally important part of the story, because who were they approving visas for? It was essentially the Afghan, the Arab Afghans, as they were called at that time, the Golden Boys in Afghanistan.
Under Osama bin Laden, right? Who were under...
Exactly right. Who at the time was working with the CIA, who was lauded in the international press, including by Robert Fisk, who I believe in 1993 even wrote a glowing article, I believe in The Independent, about this warrior for peace who's now setting the Middle East on the path to reconciliation or something like this. I mean, it was obviously a very different narrative for a very different time, but essentially Al-Qaeda, or at least the seed of what became known as Al-Qaeda, was being shipped into the United States for training at that time, and it was largely through the Jeddah consulate, or at least one part of it was through the Jeddah consulate, and Michael Springman had a direct part in that story, which he blew the whistle on. This is important for 9/11, not only because it obviously Osama bin Laden and Al-Qaeda being shipped to the U.S. For training, but more importantly, Jeddah just happens to be the consulate at which 15 of the 19 alleged 9/11 hijackers received their visa to enter the United States.
Wow.
This is beyond coincidence that almost every single one of the people on that list, at any rate, did receive their visa from that particular office.
And one consular officer, Shayna Steiner, right? She is issued 12 of the 14. And boy, she's never come forward.
No, she has been talked to, at any rate, by Michael Springman, who, in the course of researching his book called Visas for Al-Qaeda, he did track down and he did talk to Shayna Steiner and tried to get information out from her about what happened and, you know, what do you think was going on? But she was not very forthcoming with him at the time and basically left him with no further answers. But there are a few documents in the 9/11 archives that do talk about this story. If you look into the travel and visa monograph of the 9/11 Commission, there are documents appended to that include a interview with a consular officer. Obviously, the name is blocked out, but it is clearly Shayna Steiner, and it is talking about her experience and the visas that were issued. So this has been addressed in the deep, 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 deep levels of the archives of the 9/11 Commission, etc., but of course never made its way into the 9/11 Commission report or the official narrative in any substantial sense. This is a footnote of a footnote that, oh, by the way, yeah, one consular officer approved 12, or was it 14? There's different ways of counting because she issued multiple visas to some of these applicants. It's a very confusing story when you get into those weeds, but at any rate.
Well, it says she gave the visas on false info or incomplete applications, even though they gave false information and on incomplete applications. So the whole thing is that obviously something smelled there.
I need to ask a question about the hijackers. James, this one hears often that the hijackers or some of them were found still alive after 9/11. What's your take on that?
Yes, it's one of those claims that sounds so outlandish that it could not possibly be true. And it's the kind of thing that most people would roll their eyes at. And you'd think, oh, it's just in the confusion of the few weeks after 9/11. Obviously, there was a lot of conflicting information and some people just got confused.
Right.
But the more you look into it, the more there is something important and substantial there that was firmly and seemingly for all time just swept aside in late September. So the exact timeline involves, I believe, on September 14th, the FBI issued its first memo, essentially, that made it into pretty much every broadcast around the world, that these are the 19 men that we believe were the hijackers. And over the course of the next 2 weeks, there were a number of articles coming out everywhere, BBC, Independent, ABC News, everywhere that you could think of, reputable sources, quote unquote, that were all digging up information about, well, this person that they've named has turned up in Saudi Arabia, and he claims, well, I'm a pilot, but and my passport was stolen in the 1990s, but I'm obviously alive, and here I am.
Yeah, Waleed Al-Shaari from Morocco protested the use of his name and photo as a hijacker, and the FBI had to apologize to another one of them because he wasn't, I forget the name of the other guy.
Abdul Rahman.
Yeah.
Al-Omari. Yes. In fact, there were several different instances of that. And again, some of them had slightly different names or a different middle name or these types of things. So you might think it was simply a case of mistaken identity, except, of course, there were other interesting reports going around at that time, including one by Newsweek that reported that five of those people on that list had actually trained at secure U.S. military installations in the 1990s. They had sources at some of those installations talking about some of the people on that list. It was a major story for a week or so until the DOD, I believe it was the DOD, I seem to have a recollection of Condoleezza Rice at some point addressing this, but at any rate, at some point there was the official U.S. government word that, don't worry, we checked into that, and although some of the names and details were the same as the people on that hijacker list, don't worry, we checked into it, and it's different people. And that was the end of it, and that was the extent, to my knowledge, of any information that was given out
at
that time.
Mr. Mueller, you know, Mr. Mueller, who just recently ran Russiagate, he was forced to admit that the FBI wasn't certain that some of the hijackers were actually hijackers.
Yeah.
He actually came out.
Yeah,
and, so right.
He did come out and say that right before the FBI issued its final list of hijackers that included pictures. And that to this day is the official list.
Right.
It's extremely strange because there are multiple pictures of some of these alleged hijackers that clearly are different people. They are not the same person. So one of these is not the right person. Where did this photo come from? Who is this? I think this is an important issue because at the very least, it certainly raises the specter of at least identity theft of some sort. I mean, there are some people who claim that my passport was stolen in the 90s, but I'm still alive. It's very possible that some of these names, aliases, could be stolen identity, something along those lines. But that was swept under the rug so quickly that one wonders where that investigation ultimately ended up.
You know, unfortunately, like, the time is going by, and there's something that I really, really want to get to, which is, you know, I just want to start this off, and then I want you to pick this up. Let's talk about following the money. Let's talk about the fact, first of all, it seemed like when you see what happened with the first Trade Center bombing, the first one, again, the FBI has some guy inside working, you know, they have their informant, and they pull, and at some point they pull the guy out. The guy is completely freaked out because he says they're going to blow up the thing, and then they blow it up. Okay, next thing you know, on this one, the FBI, the CIA is forcing people to get visas. FBI, Cindy Sheehan, she's saying that they're shutting down information. I mean,
Colleen Riley.
Bandar Bush, you know, Bandar Bush is in the mix. Then you know, George Bush, when the whole thing happens, says, hey, you know, he tries to, like, not have an investigation. Then he tries to put, you know, Kissinger in there. So let's paint, and you know more about all this than I do, obviously, paint the whole picture in terms of the interested parties and the money portion, if you can, just try and pull it all together.
Yeah, well, I think a good window into that is the formation of the 9/11 Commission, which is one part of this whistleblower story, because it will come as a potential shock to a lot of the people out there, certainly a lot of the general public, American public, that, in fact, some of the most notable 9/11 whistleblowers are the 9/11 commissioners themselves.
Right.
Yes,
it is. Again, this is so unbelievable. The mind boggles, but 6 out of the 10 9/11 commissioners have publicly expressed concern that the commission was misled, stymied, hampered by conflicts of interest, and, of course, in the famous words of co-chairs Kane and Hamilton, set up to fail.
Well, forced, and they said they were forced to participate in a cover-up. They are Tom Keene, Lee Hamilton, Bob Carey, John Lehman, and John Romer, right?
Tim Romer and Max Cleland.
And Max Cleland,
I hope they don't take any helicopters in.
And interestingly, Bob Carey said in 2009 that 9/11 was a 30-year-old conspiracy. What was he talking about?
That's an excellent question, and one that you would think that any reporter looking to make their name would trip over themselves to ask, oh, here is a 9/11 commissioner saying that 9/11 is a 30-year conspiracy. What does he mean? Well, let's ask a follow-up. But, of course, that has never happened. That particular statement comes from a clip, which you can watch online, that was put, it was a question that was put to Bob Carey after a speech that he made in, I believe, Los Angeles back in 2009. And it was, of course, by an independent media personality who asked the question about supporting a criminal investigation into 9/11. And they had a back and forth, at which some point he says, the problem is it's a 30-year-old conspiracy. And the independent media reporter says, no, I'm talking about 9/11. And Carey says, that's what I'm talking about, and then walks away. Again, what does he mean by that? Now, there are various conclusion or various ideas that we could come up with. For example, in 2009, 30 years would be 1979. So it is possible that he's talking about Operation Cyclone to get the United States involved in Afghanistan to draw in the Soviets, which eventually led to the creation of Al-Qaeda, etc. Maybe he's talking about that narrative. But again, how do we know until someone asks him?
Right.
This does not seem like rocket science, but the fact that no one will go near this story with a 10-foot pole is probably a sign that there's something there.
Well, But I think the thing that troubles me the most is that, you know, people say Saudi Arabia, okay, fine. But it also seems to me like our own, you know, our own agencies had to have been involved in this, from the Pentagon to the CIA, State Department, et cetera, had to be involved in this for it to happen. It's such a huge operation. So many things had to happen.
But those two things are not in conflict.
Well, no, I'm not saying they are in conflict. I'm just trying to get, as you said, I'm trying to get James to give us a window into what he might think, into what his, as close to unified theory as he can possibly get. You know, what he thinks actually happened
and who
did what.
Right. Well, let's put it this way. Last year on the 9/11 anniversary, I released a documentary called 9/11 War Games, which goes into as much detail as I possibly could. It was in a 1-hour documentary about the war games that were being held on 9/11 and that directly affected the air response that day. And the fact that it is inescapable after watching that elements within the Department of Defense generally, and certainly within NORAD, had to have been involved in the suppression of the response that morning that allowed those planes to be wildly off course for a very long time without any interception. It was allowed to happen, and we can see that from a number of different angles, one of which is the war game angle, which I would suggest people check into. But you're right. I mean, whether it comes to the CIA and their various fingerprints on various operations, the FBI actually stifling ongoing investigations that were happening at that time, including into Zacharias Moussaoui and others. When it comes to the DOD and the fact that the 9/11 Commission was even considering pressing criminal charges against members of the Pentagon who they knew had deliberately lied about the timeline that morning and their response. But they did not press those charges, unfortunately. But again, it's any way that you look at it, there is no way that A, the official story is the actual story, or B, that elements within the government, certainly, and without outside of the government as well, must have known about, facilitated, and actively covered up what took place that day. It's inescapable when you come to it from a number of different angles, like the money trail, like the air response.
So the money trail, let's talk about the money trail for a minute. So the money trail is, first of all, the 3.2, did you say $3.2 trillion that the Pentagon lost? All those records were gone, boom, okay, right?
So they say.
Okay, so
well,
they say.
I mean, that's a much bigger story that goes back to the late 1990s.
I'm just saying that it's interesting, the timing of his, I'm sure there is a bigger story, but
announcing this and talking and literally saying, we're declaring a war on bureaucracy and all of this, and saying, which is an interesting pull quote from my 9/11 Trillions documentary, one might ask, how can the defense secretary attack the Pentagon in front of the American public? Something along those lines. Just stunning statements that came from that speech, delivered on September 10th, 2001, which, obviously, how could that possibly... I mean, usually they bury a story on Friday afternoon, not on Monday morning. You know, how are they going to get out of this one? Oh, 9/11, that's how.
Well, and, when you followed the money, what were the key things that you found?
There were a few different aspects that I approached it from. One is the 9/11 heist, which has to do with the destruction of the Twin Towers, the insurance, the Silverstein story that people probably have heard in some iteration before, but also about some of the remarkable information that's come out about, or that started to come out about what was found on the hard drives of some of the financial institutions that were trading in the World Trade Center up to and including 9/11. And some of the information that indicates that enormous amounts of money were being traded during the attacks, and that evidence was destroyed in the destruction of the towers, except for a company called Convar, which was working on recovering those hard drives and starting to get some of the information out of them. But then that investigation was taken over by the FBI and promptly covered up, never heard of again. Which was one of the fascinating aspects of it.
So the FBI is definitely a major participant in this 9/11 event.
There's no way around it. Absolutely. Yeah. Fingerprints all over. 9/11 insider trading, which again is a story that was it was largely reported in those weeks following 9/11 that there was massive amounts of money that was being put in put options, famously on the airlines, but less famously, there were a number of companies that were involved in those attacks that were directly impacted by those attacks that were, that there was an unusual increase in put options. And that's not a, that's not a subjective statement. That has been reviewed by, I believe, I want to say three separate scholarly research papers over the past decade have concluded there is no doubt this, there was some sort of foreknowledge of attacks that were being traded on.
But the, I guess my big question is, when you follow the money, when you follow the forensic evidence, whose fingerprints are, are actually on the carrying out of this, of this event? I mean, do you really think that these hijackers who couldn't fly planes actually did that? I mean, I know
there are factions in the 9/11 truth movement who think that there were no planes that hit the
building.
I just want
his assessment.
I didn't mean to cut you off.
I just want quickly, because we're running out of time, your assessment, given what you know about the forensic evidence, given what you know about the circumstances, you know, the timeline, given what you know about the actual thing carried out, and given what you know about the alleged hijackers, who do you think actually physically carried this out?
You mean in the planes, Christina?
The planes of, you
because
know.
Because we already addressed
who directed this thing? Who directed this thing?
A lot of the signs point back to Dick Cheney's office as being an extremely important office. And the allegation has been made that he was running PTEC software in the emergency bunker underneath the White House on 9/11. And most people will have no idea what PTEC is. But I did address that in my 9/11 Trillions documentary for people who want to delve into it. Essentially, software that would have been able to have affected and coordinated the response or lack thereof on that day, which is just another entire rabbit hole in and of itself.
My God.
There's no doubt that elements within the government and within the intelligence agencies, both in the United States and in Israel and in Saudi Arabia and in other countries, presumably, but certainly those ones
are the big
would have
three.
Been implicated in the plot.
That's what I keep hearing, Israel, U.S.
So if you were going to extraordinarily render a terrorist...
By the way, we have 2 minutes.
If you could have the power to extraordinarily render any of the, quote, terrorists involved in 9/11, who would you extraordinarily render, James?
This is probably not the way I would want to put this question, but someone who should absolutely be questioned for the part that they played in the events of 9/11, Dick Cheney, Donald Rumsfeld, would be a place to start. I think that's where we could
get
off.
It's interesting how Donald Rumsfeld is never seen or heard
anywhere. He's disappeared.
I keep thinking about that. And Condoleezza Rice and Colin Powell. Have you thought about that, James? They're just gone, those guys. They're not in the public sphere.
Well, and
only when needed. But I'm sure Darth Cheney will be getting his 15th heart transplant soon, and will become a new man, right?
Let's tell our listeners real quick, where can they find you and your great work? Give us your website.
CorbettReport.com, CorbettReport.com. All my work is there for free.
Oh, please, James, you have to come back again, because we were going to talk about propaganda.
Yeah. You were great. Thank you so much. It was great having you.
Thank you, anytime.
Thank you, James.
Okay, bye.